We're taking up some points in Hilchos Tshuva in chapter 3. And the Rambam is talking about the fact that all people have good and bad, good deeds and bad deeds. And it goes by the majority. Whatever the majority is, if they're bad, so then you're wicked. If not, you're a tzaddik. And the judgment applies to both the individual, the nation, and the world. Now, with regard to the world, we're having a bit of a question. Because the Rambam says there too that any entity that God judges, if it's evil, immediately it's destroyed. And he says the same applies to the individual, to the country, and to the world. And the proof from the world is the case of the flood. That God did destroy the entire world, with the exception of Noah. However, the question is that after the flood, God promised that he would no longer do that. That he would no longer destroy the world. And that's the sign of the covenant. Of the rainbow. The rainbow is the sign of the covenant. So that he gave to Noah, that whenever he saw the rainbow, he'll remember. I will remember my covenant between me and you and every living being among all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be, the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living being among all flesh that is on earth. And so on and so forth. The idea seems to be clear. Now, if it's true, it says that God won't bring a flood. But that's just by way of illustration, because that's the method that God chose. But the point of it is, it's not to say that I won't bring a flood, I'll destroy you a different way. What would be the benefit anyways? What would be the benefit of such a promise? The whole thing was meant to reassure Noah that he could continue with his life and he could rebuild. That's the way I interpreted it. Why was it important to communicate this to Noah? That the experiencing of the flood was a shattering experience. It's true that he was saved. On the one hand, that could be narcissistic, that you were the one that was saved. The entire world is destroyed. But we can't put ourselves in that situation. Put yourself in that situation. That the entire world has been destroyed, annihilated, and nothing is left except you and your immediate family. Not too many people. But what's the emotion? You're going to feel completely desolate. There's no question that there's going to be an absolute feeling of desolation. You do see that he had taken along the grapes, and he made wine, and he got drunk, and things happened as a result of that. Undoubtedly, the emotional condition that he was in was tough. So it's possible that God communicated this to him to give him to restore his feeling. That is, why would a person put all their energy? People are not going to put all their energy into building something and being committed unless they feel it has some permanence. Now, this can, as we've discussed it, this can take on absurd proportions that people in their 80s and 90s sometimes, they're just caught up in a fantasy of building and new projects as though they're going to be here forever. But that just goes to show you how strong that feeling is. The need to believe that what we do has value. Even though when you think about it, in the terms that we want, take a look at generations before, where are the people of 1,000 years ago? All the projects that they put all their energy into and their nervousness and their hopes and everything that seemed so important. That's the way everything that we do feels to us. And where is it now? From the framework of the universe, it doesn't seem that it's that important. All the buildings they wanted to build, all the programs they wanted to have, all the projects, every endeavor, it's gone. Every government, every emperor, nothing. However, those people at the time, if they perhaps, that's an interesting thing, if a person would fast forward, a person living in 2000 would go to 2500 looking back, he wouldn't find any trace of himself. If you could move ahead in time, if you could move to the future and from the standpoint of the future look back at your life, see if you could find your house where you lived. See if you could find all of the things that you did, all the blankets you crocheted, all the projects that you led. See if you could find the school you attended.
Pictures.
See if you could find any pictures.
Pictures.
Anybody that remembers you. any descendants from the children that you dedicated your life to, you raised children and threw all your energy into. Well, we don't do that. But there's a good reason why we don't do it. We don't look at it that way. Of course, that's not the way you should look at it. But I'm saying, being in a situation like Noach, that if people had the feeling like, I guess in California where they have those mudslides, if you feel that your house can slide down any minute, it's not a basis for a life. You can't live like that. You got to have a certain feeling of security. And you're not going to start investing in building stuff if it can be removed at any moment. So I believe that the flood was a devastating psychological blow. Because how could this happen? We considered that our endeavors in the world is just so important. How could this happen? So therefore, I'm not saying that's the reason why God said he wouldn't do it again. I'm just saying that's the reason why God communicated it to Noach. It was important for Noach to know this, so he can get going again. After all is said and done, though, if that is the case, so what is the Rambam saying? That God judges the world, and if the world is found to be evil, it'll be destroyed. But how does that fit with the sign of the covenant? We have to understand that, because if we say that the covenant is not a promise, that's a good point. That's a good point. But then what is it? Because if it means that if man does tshuva, if man lives properly, then God is saying, I won't destroy the world. Yeah, but that was the case before the flood too. Everything was a matter of justice. You don't need a covenant for that. Because God is just, and even without a covenant, God is not going to destroy mankind if they're living appropriately. I happen to agree with Irina. It seems from the Rambam that the covenant notwithstanding, there is no absolute guarantee. God is not saying that no matter what you do, you will not be destroyed. Because man has free will. So are we saying that if the entire world became corrupted, as it did in the days of the first flood, that now God would say, I don't care, I'm not going to destroy you? So we have free license? Mankind has free license to corrupt itself and to engage in all different bestial activities and just live instinctually, gratification, and oppress others, and God doesn't care? That doesn't make sense. But rather it means it's a covenant that God has done certain things. God has given man certain benefits, certain advantages that will help him, that will keep him further from reaching the point of no return. What happened in the first instance was there was a spiraling effect that the instinctual element in man began to get more powerful. It started with the sexual, and they just took women at their own, whatever they wanted to. That's a dangerous phenomenon. That's why I talk about contemporary life. It's very, very dangerous because we're living in a society today where that's part of the culture that is based upon total gratification of all the desires of man. It's increasing the power of the instinctual to the point where the instinctual can no longer be controlled. That's a tremendous danger. And that's what is described. It keeps getting stronger and stronger. So the divine aspect of man keeps retreating, keeps diminishing. And man's capacity for intelligent activity, restraint, and living in accordance with reason begins to diminish till it reaches the point of no return. Similar. The covenant means that God took safeguards. There's no absolute guarantee. There's no absolute guarantee. God took safeguards and made it more difficult for man. The tripwires, so to speak, made it more difficult for man to reach that point, essentially by making man, from the physical standpoint, a much more diminished character. The lifespan of man begins to get shorter. Man becomes weaker. Man was exceedingly powerful, egocentric, and he lived hundreds and hundreds of years before the sin. All of that went to his head. And the covenant has to do with the changed nature of man. There's a number of different things. And then the fact that there's competition among the nations, that you'll never have that type of unity. A lot of different factors. God built in many factors that would have that tendency to prevent that disaster from occurring. But can it occur? Did God take away the free will that man has for evil? No. Take a look at the evil. Is anyone going to say that we haven't seen, from a qualitative standpoint, the character of evil that would be responsible for the destruction of the world? What about communists, Russia, and Nazi Germany, and Pol Pot? Many, many societies are engaged in that kind of evil. However, there are other factors that tend to prevent it from ever sweeping across the world. But let's say it did. It doesn't mean to say that God is always going to intervene and prevent you from using your free will for evil. So perhaps that's what the Rama means. That the covenant is that he shouldn't be worried. That life is life. Human life is human life. Those are the rules of the game. Man has free will. Free will means there can be evil. But the covenant is saying that it'll be very difficult to come to that point again. Destruction, I won't destroy you. God did not say, according to this interpretation, if you are deserving of destruction, I will not destroy you. That's not the way the Rambam interprets it. God merely said, God put it that way, because God put it to him as though I'll never destroy it, because perhaps he wanted to give him confidence. But what it really meant was that due to all the changes that I'm making, it'll be very difficult to reach that point. There'll be tripwires. It'll be very difficult to reach that point at which justice would demand that I destroy it. Okay? So that's a reassurance, but doesn't mean it's an absolute. Okay. Let's continue. Moving on now in the Rambam, that's chapter 3, Halacha Beis. The Rambam talks about the shikol, the weighing in the balance, the determination. So the Rambam then says that this weighing is not in accordance with the number, the quantity of merits and demerits, but rather according to the quality. So therefore, there's a schus, there's a merit, which can offset many sins. As it says, because he found in him a davar tov, a good thing, that God will tilt the scale sometimes because of one good thing. That's an amazing idea. So that a person can appear, to all intents and purposes, to us, he can appear like a horrible person. But he may have one good quality that we're not aware of, or we are aware of. It doesn't make any difference. That one good quality can offset many bad deeds. You see, it's a complex thing. It's not a simplistic thing like children. Yeah, you count up your good deeds. Give me an example. Let's see if we can think of an example. What would come to mind? What would be that one good thing which would offset a number of bad things? Does it mean one particular deed or one quality, one character trait that a person has? Well, we all say that, by the way. Sometimes, in relationships, sometimes you can complain, listing all the bad things about this person. You know, husbands and wives will sometimes do that. Wives and husbands. But that one thing, he has that one good quality. You list off about 25 bad things. And then, so why don't you get rid of him? That one good thing that he has. Merit. Merit, the Rambam uses the words schuyos, which is merits. Merits are not simply good deeds. He would have said that. He would have said masim. He would have said deeds. Because it's too simplistic. Bear in mind also that, wouldn't you say that the quality of the deed, for example, let's say you help people, but the kind of thing you help them with is things that you enjoy doing. Let's say someone will coach a kid's baseball team, help kids, disadvantaged kids. Well, that's a good deed. However, do we not take into consideration that he really loves what he's doing because he always wanted to be the big daddy and the coach, and he's playing baseball and he's fulfilling his own fantasy of being a baseball coach or a manager? Now, that doesn't mean it's not a good deed. I know this is complex. Life is very complex, and we all gravitate towards the easy good deed. I always talked about that. People are, generally speaking, better behaved on airplanes. I know I am. I help out people that are getting on the plane and having trouble lifting their baggage, etc. You know, older people generally, because young people, it's not a problem.
Because you want them to be a stewardess?
No, it's easy. Because it's very easy. in a short period of time, you get to do a few good deeds. And it's not like these people are going to keep coming back to you and so on and so forth. It's much more difficult in terms of your neighborhood, where it's an ongoing thing and it takes up more time and so on and so forth. I call it, quote-unquote, cheap chesed. It's cheap. I don't mean to negate it. It's a good thing, but I don't think a person should get carried away with themselves. Also, it makes it more pleasant than people think you're a good person. You get a certain amount of gratitude. Of course, it's all good. I'm not saying you should practice good things no matter what, the other motivations. Yeah, but I don't know if you can compare the quality of that to someone who gives up their time. Also, bear in mind, this person may not have much to do. He's lonely, he's bored, whatever. So it's a good outlet, it's a social outlet. That's smart. Use that energy for a mitzvah. But is that the same as people who give up hours of their time with the needy or the elderly or with children, teaching them, doing things that are hard, that are really hard and draining, and they don't really get any enjoyment from it in and of itself, other than the fact that they did a good thing? Working with sick children, and you don't really enjoy doing it. That's some personalities enjoy doing it. Some people don't. Doing things you don't really enjoy only because your recognition that this is a good thing to do for the sake of the other person, because you care about the other person's feelings. I think everybody would agree that's a much higher level. So you see that it's very difficult for us. We really can't determine the value of the good deed. This is a very important question. We're raising this question now, whether that's correct. Should a person gravitate towards doing those chesed activities that he's attracted to in their own right? He enjoys that. That's the way people are. They tend to, but that's a good thing. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, because the doing of chesed is a good thing, even if it has other motivations. The question we're asking is it equal to the chesed that you do where you're lacking those incentives? Things that you do not enjoy doing. Let's say you go to the... Some people may enjoy going to the hospital and visiting the sick, and make cheering them up, because it all has to do with your personality. If you're good at that and you enjoy that, and fine. If you're not, there are many activities which you're not good at, you don't enjoy doing, but you do it because you recognize there's a job that has to be done. Is there a difference in terms of the impact on the soul of the two kinds of deeds? Spending time with people, you could spend time with two groups of people. One that you actually get some gratification from because you enjoy it. You know, sort of like athletes go and play ball with the kids. So that's what they do. They enjoy that. Or doing things that you don't really enjoy at all, but you can do them, but you're doing them because of the mitzvah. In the book of Rus, which we're going to read on Shavuos, it opens with the story of Naomi and Rus. And the main theme seems to be the conversion of Rus, that Rus was attracted to the perfection, the personality of Naomi. And after their husband died, the two wives of Naomi's two sons, both of her husband and her two sons died. So it's a tragedy. And then the famine ended and she's going back to the land of Israel, and the girls want to go with her. And she discourages them from going, which you're supposed to do, because initially when a person wants to convert, the initial reaction is to discourage them. However, they persist. Finally, one of the daughters-in-law leaves and Rus stays, and then Rus says, no matter what you do, I'm not going to part from you. Wherever you go, I will go. And where you live, I'll live, and so on and so forth. Where you die, I'll die, and so forth. Then, I'm going to be saying over an interpretation of the Vilna Gaon. Then verse 18 states that Naomi saw that she was determined, that she, nisametzes is the Hebrew word, that she was firm to go. And then she stopped talking to her. That is, she let go, she relented, and she let her come with her. She let her convert. So there's an interesting commentary by the Vilna Gaon. What does it mean that she saw that she was struggling, she was forcing herself to go? So just to say it over briefly, the gist of it, he was giving the idea that there's the good inclination in man and the evil inclination in man. And by nature, man by nature, in accordance with his instinctual nature, he's drawn after his instincts, his evil inclination. But the good inclination is kind of a contrary, that a person doesn't have any natural desire to do the good. So that he has to do, he has to force himself. Now he says this point, that sometimes the evil inclination in man can't win out, can't get its way, because the person opposes it. So you may have a desire to do something, but then the other side of you, your knowledge, your reason, or your conscience, whatever it is, will oppose it. And you can defeat, you're overpowering the evil inclination. So he says, in that case, sometimes the evil inclination tries a different maneuver. And that is that it masquerades, it dresses itself up in the form of a mitzvah. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean it dresses itself up? That means very often a person has this sense that they want to do something, this project, this program, this great deed. And they're filled with tremendous amount of passion and energy and desire for it. But it could be that beneath the surface, the real reason, what you're attracted to is not the ideal that is appealing to your mind, but there's some instinctual gratification that lurks behind it. That's what we call a lo lishma, not for its own sake. So, how do you know the difference?
I don't know.
I don't think this idea is very popular. So when a person has the idea, the desire to do a mitzvah, how do you know if it's really something which is coming from your good inclination? Or it's just something coming from your evil inclination. So he says, yeah, you don't have, if there's a tremendous urge and desire and passion, like you see sometimes a person is a Baal Tshuva and all of a sudden overnight they're filled with this tremendous energy. He says, then you for sure it's not coming from the good inclination. The energy is coming from the evil inclination. But if you want to do it and you're struggling, it's a struggle and it's difficult and it's not easy, there's a battle, then you know it's coming from the good inclination. He says, that's what it means over here. That Naomi listened to Ruth. Ruth said, where you go, I'll go, that she wanted to do it. But then she was struggling. She was following her, but she was struggling. She had resistance, and she was overcoming. What she had to overcome, she had to fight. So when she saw overcoming and fighting, then she saw that it's something that's not just like his crazy religious zeal. It's something real, and then she accepted her. If you're doing it, I think this relates to the point we're making. Cal was saying that it's good to do chesed, but to the extent that the chesed has become, well, I guess what they call egosyntonic, it's in line, it's been absorbed by our egoistic drives, you could satisfy a lot of egotistical things when you help people, when you teach people. So you enjoy it, and you also you get recognition, and so on and so forth. So it's true, you're going out of your way. I don't think that's the essence of real chesed. The essence of chesed has to be where the motivation is solely because of the ideal of chesed itself. And there, if you're doing things, and there's no recognition, and there's no enjoyment, and the only reason you're doing it is because of your love of God and your ability to gear your actions in terms of what God would demand of you, that's the real perfection. A, you get to know all the emotions, you get to see your real nature, whereas in the other case, you can really pat yourself on the back. Look what I did. I devoted 14 hours. Yeah, but those 14 hours, a lot of it was for the self too. All that is good. I don't mean to say it's not good. But I don't know that it's the ultimate perfection. The ultimate perfection is where a person is in a situation where there's no emotional desire to do it in and of itself. And what's guiding you now is that your ideas and your values, your belief that this is what God wants you to do. Correct. Hold on a second. I don't want people to get the wrong impression. We have to be realistic as to what our level is. And all things being equal, a person should plan their activities, their lives, The more it's something that you're going to enjoy and be good at, the better for everybody. Better for you, better for the person you're trying to help. I agree with that 1,000%. We're talking the abstract, though, that there is a necessity of going beyond that. If we truly want to achieve the perfection that exists in the framework of chesed, it can't just be the things that we want to do, because then you're saying, I'm sharing my selfishness with others. That's not true chesed on the highest level. Let me give you an example. In a relationship, let's say someone's going out with someone, and they're pretty much into each other, they like each other a lot, or they're in love. So then, let's say each one does for the other one. She does things for him, whatever. She goes out of her way, she knows he needs help, and she picks up his things, she goes to the city for him. And he is that, wow, you're so wonderful. I met a girl, she's so terrific, she's so wonderful. Look at all the things she does. Meaning that she's got this midah of chesed. But let's be honest, that's not much of a barometer. The only reason she's doing it is she doesn't do this for everybody. She's doing it because she loves you. And obviously that's very selfish. And the same is true what you're doing for her. You don't do this for everybody. So I think in that case, most people would recognize that it's kind of selfish. The same is true with children, most of the time. It's a highly selfish thing. Because you don't do this for every child that needs help, you're doing it for your own. Now, that's the way of the world, that's the design, that's how God designed it, because basically we are selfish creatures. And that's a beginning, that's a starting point. Because there are some people that are so caught up in themselves, they can't put any energy into helping anybody else. It's got to be just them. So undoubtedly that is a good thing, and then you do see from this that the design of the world is that man should become perfected by being selfish. You should be selfish. Intelligently selfish. You come first. Your life comes first. That's selfish. Judaism is selfish. But there is a concept of chesed that has to do with the perfection of our souls. And we should recognize what that is and strive to partake of that as well. So we don't know what the real merits are that can offset many bad characteristics, and we don't know the other way around either. We can't really judge. Although I would think that in the realm, is it equal? Is it the same on both sides? That we really cannot judge what the superior merits are, what they are. Is it the same that we can't really judge the significance of the evil deeds also? And that we can't differentiate one from the other in saying that it must be true that one evil deed can offset many goods. Is it true that we have no clue over there either? So, I would say in the realm of the evil, we definitely have a clue. You can differentiate between the severity of wrong things. There's jaywalking is also wrong. Throwing a wrapper out of your window when you're driving instead of waiting for a garbage disposal, that's wrong. But that's not the same as stealing. That's not the same as beating somebody up. I mean, there you could see a hierarchy. Not that we know. We don't know specifically because there's many other things that go into it. The extent of the person's temptation, the person's nature, and so forth. So that's what the Rambam says. V'yesh avon, there's a sin. But you got to be careful because you can make a mistake. We tend to downplay the seriousness of our defects. I think that's true. Right? Because whenever we have to defend ourselves, we are always defending ourselves. So when we start thinking we feel guilty about the bad things, we tend to sort of downplay them. They're not that bad compared to the good that I do. Everybody's playing this game. Trying to arrive at some kind of a defense. Well, as we'll see, psychologically it's necessary. Psychologically, a person is not permitted to get caught up in these morbid feelings that he's a Russia, that he's a wicked person. That the Rambam will come to that. And he quotes, so as he says, V'ein shoklin ala b'daito shel kel deos, that this kind of a balancing, to arrive at these conclusions and give a definition, that's only God. Only God has the knowledge for this. Man does not have the knowledge. Which kind of means that you will never know about anybody, and including yourself, whether in the eyes of God, right now, you would qualify as a tzaddik or a rasha or a beinoni. You don't know. He knows, only God knows, how to evaluate the merits and measure the merits versus the sins. Now the Rambam in Halacha Gimel says, whoever regretted the mitzvos that he did, and he wondered about them, and he said in his heart, what did I gain by doing them? That's an interesting kind of regret, because generally regret works the other way. When we're studying about tshuva, we're always talking about regretting the bad things that we did. Now the Rambam introduces an amazing idea, which I don't know if it happens that frequently, I'm not sure. Regretting the good things that you did. So let's say this person has merits. And these merits, were they brought into the balance, would help them. However, there's another condition. That is that even though you may be lapsed, or whatever it is, but you don't have this negative attitude. If a person has a negative attitude towards the good that he did, that's very serious. For example, he says, Halavai lo asisio son, I wish I hadn't done it. Then he says, I raise a ebed as kulon. He's lost them all. They go right out of his account, so to speak. V'ein maskirin lo shum zchus ba'olam. And we do not bring forward for him any merit at all. As it says, he quotes a pasuk for this too, that the righteousness of the right of the tzaddik will not save him on the day of his evil, on the day of his sin. So what's the righteousness of the righteous? What do you mean the righteousness won't save him? What else is going to save him? It means, the Rambam says, Ein ze el betoa al harishonos. This is with regard to this individual who has second thoughts about the good that he did. He regrets the good that he did. Now, before we go further, what's the reason for that? I mean, obviously, if the person, we're talking about someone who was good, and now the person is a sinner. Because all things being equal, we have two individuals now, whose merits and demerits would be the same. Let's say a person was good, and now he's got some demerits. He's not following the same path. So when God judges him, he's going to count. All the good that you stored up is going to count for you. It'll be taken into consideration. The mitzvahs were done.
Yeah.
The second person is the person who's not, his actions are no different than the first person, except he looks back and he says, what did I benefit from all the mitzvahs? So it's just a mental attitude. That his mental attitude towards what he did will cause him to lose it. Meaning, if you don't have that mental attitude, you did what you did, now you're living differently. And you don't regret the past, even though you're not living that way anymore. So they'll be counted. That's part of your bank account. But if you regret the good that you did, so then you'll lose all of your benefits. Now why? The question is, why would the person lose all the benefits? The person, if that's the principle of judgment, if that is the principle of judgment, that is, the Rambam set down the rules. God judges, God knows how to weigh the good versus the bad. So you too should have, what do I care that you regret or don't regret? Let's take a look at the good versus the bad and then reach a conclusion. It's interesting. Let me ask the question in a human framework. Let's say, let's set that up. Let's say somebody did a lot of good for you, good things, favors and all of that. And you feel that you owe them something for as a result of it. Now, maybe the situation will come in which you could pay them back, maybe it won't. But in your mind, if they, you put them in a certain category, if they ever needed your help on a certain level, you'd give it to them. But let's say the relationship changes and you get into a bit of a spat. Now, you get into a spat with someone doesn't mean that you forget all the good they did. That counts. But let's say a result of that spat and they say to you, and you know all those things I did for you and everything I helped you with, etc., etc., it was a waste of time. I wish I hadn't have done it. And they leave. Now, you're pretty much in the same situation. Oh, how would that affect you? Would you still have the same attitude if the person says, you know, everything that I did for you was a waste of time, I shouldn't have done it, and I wish I had, if I could take it back, I would take it back. What would your attitude be? Would you still feel the same sense of obligation if the next day that person needed you? the situation which previous to that incident you would have been willing to help them with, now it arises, but what happened, what transpired in between was that collision in which they did say those things. And they haven't called back to take it back. They haven't called you back to rescind. That's where they left you with. A feeling that they regret all of the good that they did. What I think is, and it's similar to something we discussed before, when the Rambam said at the very outset that all people have good and bad, merits and demerits. And then we raised the question, well, what about certain people like extreme wicked people like Hitler and so on and so forth? And then someone said that, well, he must have done some good things in his life. He must have done when he was a kid or so on and so forth. But the answer to that is, yeah, but that was before he became Hitler. Now, all things being equal, what this means is that, let's say, a person is a complex mechanism. People are not simple. That's why it's very difficult to say whether the person is righteous or the person is wicked. Because the person has certain aspects that are good, certain good deeds that they do. And then the person has certain attraction, attachments, and certain bad things that they do. So it's sort of like the two forces are sort of fighting with each other. And God takes note of that. That God gives you the credit for the good that you do. Even if right now you've changed. So let's say a person, when they were younger, they did certain mitzvos, they did good things, so on and so forth. And as they get older, they're more lax. They're not doing the same things anymore. But that what you did in the past is still a part of you. That is still part of you. It's there. It has its impact. And you never know. The good deed has an impact. Because the good deed has an effect upon the soul. That's the whole idea over here. It's not a question of a simple calculation, numbers. It's the state of the soul. That's why we really don't know. And there's certain dimensions of the soul which have been shaped by the good things. Everything you do is shaping your soul. That's the significance. Every time you follow an instinct, an unwarranted desire, it's having an impact upon your soul. Your soul is now becoming more attached to the physical. Every time you overcome that and you direct your energy towards the good, so that's an impact upon the soul. It's not the same soul anymore. So now that's the idea that the good deeds that you did are part of you. And even if you're a lapsed individual, it doesn't matter. We still have to take into consideration those good deeds because a situation will arise, and because of those good deeds, you'll be motivated. Very often a person has a regret. He remembers what he did and he wants to go back to doing that. It's still there. Let's put it that way. But that's only as long as, even though I'm not living up to that standard that I used to live up to, but I don't regret it. I still recognize its validity. And maybe I feel bad, but what's it? Now it's different. Now I'm in the business world. Now I have this. I can't do it. I have other things. But I don't renounce it. However, the individual is designed in such a way that he can renounce. He can break his connection to what he did. He can, just as we've seen, the tshuva, the Rambam says that the approach, the derech of a Baal tshuva, is to change his name, to change his identity, to become a different person. As if to say, I'm a different person, I'm not the same person. It's a matter of identification. So part of doing tshuva is to break our identification with a certain type of a self-image, with a certain type of a personality, which is connected to a kind of a lifestyle. Oh, so now that that's possible, it can work the other way as well. That a person can have a certain embrace of a false way of life in which it causes him to renounce his past. And when he renounces it, he breaks his identification, as if to say that the person that did all those good things, that's not me. That was some fool. And when that's what the Rambam is saying. It's not a punishment. When he does that, then you can't bring into the mix any one of the good deeds because he's broken himself away. He severed his attachment So those good deeds have no relationship to the present soul, to the present personality. That's what I think the Rambam means. To renounce it. If that is the idea of renunciation. You can renounce your past. And thus, let's say that when Hitler underwent the change and made his decision and his choice of what he wanted to be, then whatever good, that was an all-embracing phenomenon. And he broke his attachment to all, he looked back and he said, oh, all that morality that I practiced, whatever he practiced, he did. He renounced that. He said, that's absurd. That's part of some crazy religious system. And so on and so forth. I wish I hadn't done that. So therefore, by doing that, it uproots any kind of an impact that any good deeds might have had. Whereas an ordinary person, even if, as I said, if he's lapsed, even if he's not practicing mitzvos, but he did do mitzvos, and those mitzvos did have an effect upon him, and psychologically he may be hindered from doing certain things. Just because of that, he won't do certain things. That, I think, is what the Rambam is saying.